Well, good evening. It's a pleasure to be with all of you. Some of you I've met before, others happy to make your acquaintance on this evening. I'm sorry that what brings us together is the subject matter at hand, but it is nonetheless a pleasure to be here with you guys this evening. There's a saying that you often hear in politics, and it goes like this. Insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. Now, that's not the formal legal definition of insanity, but there's a bit of truth in it that's worthy of us to pay attention to. If we resort to raising our children in a similar way to the ways that we were raised 20, 30, or 40 years ago, we will end up with very different results. And often, those results will be quite saddening to us. If I were to mimic the well-intentioned, fearful passivity of my parents, my children would potentially turn out quite different than I did in the 1980s. For many years, Christian parents in the United States had the luxury of kind of leaning on and assuming that the church or the Judeo-Christian culture was going to raise their children in the ways of the Lord, that was really going to aid them in their efforts. This is a little bit spiritually lazy, but nonetheless, it seemed to work for the most part. But you, I want to challenge you to believe that you are the generation that actually must change what has been done in the past, that you need to start thinking differently, that we are living in a postmodern and a post-Christian nation, and that is worthy of paying attention to. God's called you and myself to be the primary shepherds of our children's hearts and their faith. That's always been true, but it's never been more of a challenge in this country than it is right now. Our time together is entitled Confronting the Plague of Pornography. So we have to ask the question, what is a plague? The definition for you on the screen. You know, if you think in the historical context, maybe the Black Death in Europe, 1340s to the mid-1700s, 75 million people died from the Black Death. That's a lot of people. Plagues they're a disastrous evil, it says. Epidemics, unwelcomed outbreaks, they're spreading faster than they can be contained. Now, if you know anything about history, Christians in the church have often risen to the occasion amidst plagues that have happened in culture and in societies. The church was known for its efforts during Black Death. They're known for their response and engagement during these difficult times. And there's kind of two primary ways that they engaged. And the first was the church had doctrine or a theology that allowed those around them to better understand what was happening. And specifically, that is the effects of sin in the world, which include disease and death. So the church brought to the table a framework of thinking that explained the death that people were seeing all around them. Secondly, the church brought forward action. There was a theology that allowed believers to move towards their neighbors who were in distress. When the knee-jerk reaction would be to self-protect and to pull away, the church moved forward, and they were not immune to the plague. Christians during that time, many passed away after being in physical contact with their neighbors who were suffering. But the church did not retreat. They confronted the plague boldly. 75 million lives were claimed in the Black Death, which spread over the years, and no one had the ability to contain it. The plague of pornography is claiming lives in a different fashion. It's a hidden illness for the most part. You can't see it on my skin. The symptoms, they're hard to see. The afflicted are largely anonymous. And those that are affected are not numbering in the tens of millions like Black Death. They're numbering in the hundreds of millions. But it's an opportunity for the church and for Christian parents to confront this plague once again, to engage the plague of pornography, both with sound doctrine and also with taking action. I want to show you some statistics just to help you get a handle on what's happening right now in regards to pornography. These are from the Center for Parent and Youth Understanding, Walt Mueller's organization. He says 93% of boys and 62% of girls are exposed to internet pornography before the age of 18. The average age of first exposure to internet pornography is 11 years old. I personally was exposed to hardcore lesbian pornographic video when I was 12 years old. 20 to 30% of all Google searches are either directly linked to or related to something having to do with sex or pornography. 34% of internet users have received unwanted exposure to sexual material. And finally, one poll indicates that 50% of evangelical Christian men and 20% of evangelical Christian women are addicted to pornography. It's very important for us as parents to understand that boys and girls struggle with pornography. It's one of the easiest drugs to obtain in our culture. It's easy to use compulsively and even to become addicted to. And the message is this: sex is easy. It's for you. You can have access to another person's body whenever and however you want. No one has to know, and no one's going to get hurt. That's the message behind pornography. Now, as parents, you and I have been tasked by God with shepherding the little ones that He's entrusted to us. This is exciting. It's a little bit intimidating. It can feel like this enormous task at times that's an overwhelming burden. For some of you who have older children, when I say that you are the primary spiritual influence in your child's life, that might bring a little bit of shame, maybe guilt or regret. But I want to encourage you that it's never too late to make some adjustments. And if you have young little ones in the house, it's never too early to start shepherding their hearts as it relates to their sexuality. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5 through 9 says this: "You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand. They shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." This is a command highlighting parents the task we have to disciple our kids. But this was written not in the context of seeking out individual families, tasking them with this. This was written to the body of believers, the people of God, written to the church. We're not to act individualistically in this way. I know for myself it's a difficult truth for me to swallow, and that is that I need you, and you need one another, and that we need the body of Christ as we seek to disciple our kids. You might not like it, it might be messy, but you need each other. You need the church. You need what this school has to offer. God made it that way. If you don't like it, take it up with Him. But as we start to talk about pornography, it's important for us to realize this, and that is sex is not the problem. Pastor and author Paul Tripp puts it this way, quote, "It's very tempting to blame sex, societal values, the mainstream media, or technology as the problem. But here's the humbling truth. Sex is not the problem, nor is our environment the primary problem. The act of sex, as God designed, is beautiful and rewarding, not evil. And we can't try to live as modern-day monastics, as if retreating from the TV and internet would suddenly cure our hearts from sexual sin. The counterintuitive reality is that it's only ever the evil inside our hearts that draws us to the evil that's outside in our world. In summary, we are the problem. More specifically, our heart and what it asks of sex is the problem." End quote. So our hearts, the sin that lingers in us, is the problem. Scripture says we're born into sin. Apart from Christ, we are dead in our trespasses and our sins, Ephesians 2. Jesus offers us freedom from the slavery of sin, Romans 6. The gospel of Jesus is the solution. It's the solution for our salvation, but it's also the solution for our day-to-day path and struggle with sanctification. If we're going to talk about pornography, we might as well have a working definition. So we're going to try this one on for size. Pornography is the portrayal of erotic behavior designed to cause sexual excitement. It is words, acts, or representations that are calculated to stimulate sex feelings, independent of the presence of another loved and chosen human being. It's divorced from reality in that its sole purpose is to stimulate erotic response. So that definition is quite broad, actually. It allows lots of room. It could be anything that would cause you to think in this way. The word pornography is rooted in the Greek word porneia, which means to practice prostitution or just general sexual immorality or fornication. So in the New Testament, Paul uses this word in a variety of different ways, which I think is good for us because it allows us to understand this broader spectrum of what pornography is. It's referring to any kind or sinful, illegitimate sexual desire or expression. That we can label pornography. So you might be asking, why now, John? Pornography's been around for a long time. Why on earth should we? Does it demand that we use the language of it's a plague amongst us? Well, teenagers have struggled with sexual sin for thousands of years. Lusting, masturbating, having oral sex, having sex outside of marriage. People have experienced the dark side, the broken side of rape and abuse. But something has changed in recent years. Something is different about what our kids are facing that no generation of human beings that have ever walked the face of the earth have ever experienced. Did you hear that? Something's different with what our children are facing, and it has to do with the internet access as well as the smartphone. I want you guys to wrestle with this question for a minute. You don't have to wrestle, just think backwards a little ways. How many of you had a portable, private access to the internet when you were in high school? Did anyone have portable, private access to the internet when you're in high school? If you did not, then you and I must wake up to the fact that we grew up with a different set of temptations than our kids have right now. This means that you and I must be willing to learn, to be educated, in order to understand their world, because it is different. As technology has developed, so has pornography, and pornography is often one of the largest initiatives in pushing new technologies forward. Before there was much technology, we just had physical prostitution, and that's been around since the earliest human beings. When the printing press was developed, that quickly led to print posters and pinups of the late 1800s. Playboy magazine debuted in 1953. That was not that long ago. In 1953, their first issue came out featuring Marilyn Monroe. She was the centerfold. She didn't even consent to those pictures being published in Playboy. She had sold them to a different source that sold them then to Playboy magazine. Their first edition sold out 54,000 copies of a brand new magazine. As big screen cinema was developed, so did porn flicks. Then porn was brought into the home with VHS and DVDs. And the world became a different place when the internet was developed. Now you have internet in your pocket 24/7. It's instant and it's anonymous. Some of you might feel a little overwhelmed by that. You might be thinking, well, what's left out there to be tempted with? Well, I would say, hold on to your hats. Do not be deceived. The porn industry is one of the top three technology developers working hard right now on virtual reality technology. Their goal is to produce pornography in a frighteningly real 360-degree interactive experience. Now, I work with youth and young adults, and I fear that this will be the crack cocaine of pornography. One use, and it'll be very difficult not to be addicted. No other human beings have ever faced temptations like these. As parents, it's our job to regulate what comes into our homes and what is put in front of our children. When our children are young, you, parent, are morally responsible for what they're seeing, for what they're doing, for what they're listening to. If they have screens, when they have access, what they watch, what games they play, those decisions are yours. They're your decisions. You bear the burden of what is happening in your home. I want you to to sit with that and allow yourself to feel that, how they spend their free time, what toys they have, what technology they have. Those are adult decisions that are yours to make. And I would encourage you to take very seriously the decisions you're making that are connected to entertainment and technology as it relates to what's in your house or what's in your pocket or what's in your child's pocket. Now, entertainment and technology are not evil. They're not. In and of themselves, there's amazing things that come with entertainment and technology. Don't hear me hating on all forms of technology and media. But I want us to be aware that there's a truth behind the fact that that technology is one of the primary catechisms of our world. It's one of the primary tools that's being used to instruct and teach and influence those around us. As we leave here, I'm going to give you a handout, so don't leave without that. I have one, I think, for every person or every couple that's here. And that's going to have some very specific kind of detailed, some statistics and resources and some questions to ask and ways to think about maybe your own child. So I'm not going to cover some of those things while we're here now, because I'm going to send you home with those. But what I'd like to do is to get your brains thinking a little deeper. I want us to do a little hard work to think about the problem behind the presenting problem of pornography usage. Pornography teaches a lie, and the lie is this: that you can see someone else or be seen yourself as an object without consequence. That you can see another human being or allow yourself to be seen as an object, which is inanimate, without consequence. So let's start simple for a second. Have you noticed that our culture hypersexualizes women? If you haven't, you live in a box. Okay? Have you noticed that magazines made for men feature scantily dressed women? You have. Have you noticed that magazines that are marketed for women feature scantily dressed women? That should beg a question of us, should it not? The question is, why is this the case? Why does sexy sell to both men and women? Why are women okay with being objectified? Many feminists will even support and argue for the pornography industry. This gets us thinking a little bit about producers and consumers of pornography. Sexy is attractive to the producer because it gives them a sense of power. They can use this person to get what they want. Sexy is also attractive to the consumer because they want to have it, and getting what you want makes you feel a sense of powerfulness. So both men and women desire good things: relational security, control, and a sense of agency or power over those things. But we have many disordered desires due to the sin nature that's in us. And pornography is one outflow of a desire for control or power working its way out in a sinful way. Now, I want to try to illustrate this for you guys using an example from pop music instead of pornography. So we're asking the question, why would both male and female artists, because we're talking about music now, seek to hypersexualize women? Both male and female artists, why would they both seek to hypersexualize women? So I'm going to show you two examples, kind of two different case studies from two ends of this music spectrum. I'm going to show you a case study from kind of a harder rap culture, and then I'm going to show you something from kind of lighter pop culture. The rap is still in the pop category. The first one I'm going to show you in just a second is from a music video which has over 1 billion views. You just need to soak that in for a second. 1 billion views, and this is not appealing to large sections of demographics around the world. So this is predominantly youth culture, Western youth who are watching this. And in it, we're going to see, if you were to watch it, you'd see many women dancing and being displayed as objects for one of the singers, this guy Ozuna, who's a Puerto Rican rapper. They're there for his pleasure. They're objectified for their sexiness. This is a song that's called Taki Taki. It's out right now. If you listen to Q101, which I'm sure you do all the time, you will hear this song. Very important. It's a joint effort by DJ Snake, Ozuna, and Cardi B. If you're 14 years old, those names make sense to you. Also in this video, special guest Cardi B, who's a female singer. In the scenes when she's singing, she's chosen to hypersexualize herself, and surrounding her are a group of other women that are also scantily dressed, but they are, in a sense, under her authority. She is leading them in the dance routine. She is kind of exercising a sense of power over them. They are submitting to her, and they also are objectified for their sexiness. So if you'd be willing to grab the lights for me, I just want to show you two pictures from this music video. And I show these to you for your education. They're a little bit risque. There's no nudity in them, but if you would prefer not to see them, I would understand that. You can just look away for a moment. This is the first video, the first shot. You'll see the gentleman here in the black leather. This is Ozuna, and he has these ladies around him who are very much just there as objects in the film. Here's the second scene. This is Cardi B. You see her in the back. She's kind of got this queen robe behind her. She's obviously hypersexualized, and she has this crew of women around here who are dancing and a bit under her authority. If you're looking away, you can look back now. So in this video, you have men hypersexualizing women, and you have a woman who is fantastically content to hypersexualize herself and to pull other women into that same category. Now, some of you might not be startled by what you saw because you don't have a taste for rap music. You think it's all from the devil anyway. So I want to introduce you to another case study. Case study number two is a song entitled "Look What You Made Me Do." This song is written by Taylor Swift, and this song also has over 1 billion views on YouTube. Taylor Swift is one of the more influential women in the world of music. This year, or 2018, she was ranked number 68 in most influential women in the world by Forbes. She's the youngest on the list out of the top 100. She's worth over $350 million. She's an extremely talented singer and songwriter. And many youth that are currently young people, 25 and under, grew up on Taylor Swift. And surprising to some, in this video of her song, she has very similar depictions of the first two pictures that you just saw. But Taylor is in the center of both of them. She has hypersexualized herself and portrays herself in a position of power. And I want to show you a couple just to help you make the connection. Again, if you would like to not see these, please look away for a moment. Here you have Taylor Swift in the red boots on the right. And she has a team of young ladies who are there for no other reason than kind of be sexualized objects. They're portraying mannequins of some sort. And then you get this picture, which is very similar to the one we saw in the other video. Taylor's on stage behind the podium, also wearing a nice little cape thing, dressed like a 1993 prostitute. And in front of her, she has what is an army of women. And in the film, they are at attention in front of her. It's very, very much, she is in control, in command, at their lead. She's using, again, sexuality combined with the concept of power. If you were looking away, you can look back now. This is intriguing to me. A woman objectifying herself and other women, portraying to the viewer of this film, 1 billion plus, this is power. This is how you exercise control over other people. If you watch that whole music video from Taylor Swift, it's quite interesting. Almost in every single scene, she is, and it's like quick, she is in a different outfit, in a different position of power or authority, be it money or control over a leopard or driving a Lamborghini or managing this group of women. She is portraying herself as powerful, but most all of them are hypersexualized. I want to show you one more picture. This one, we can just leave the lights up on it. Taylor takes it one step farther than Cardi B. About 3/4 of the way through the song, she's dancing with a different group. It's no longer women. Now she's dancing with a group of men. And this group of men is one that she has chosen to hypersexualize as well. Each man is dressed in high heels and pantyhose and crop tops that say, "I love T. Swift." And you can look away if you wouldn't want to see this one. I don't really like it too much either. So you have Taylor in the front, but each of the dancers in the background are men. Taylor's bought into the lie that she can be seen as an object without consequence, that she can sexualize other women without consequence, that she can feminize men as a way to empower them. Taylor truly believes that she is expressing control and agency when I would say she's actually given all the power away to another by objectifying herself. When you choose to objectify yourself, you're giving the power that you have just as a human being away to the one who is observing you as an object. Are you with me? This is what I'm fearful our young people are not capturing, because it takes a little thinking to understand it. Now, you might be asking, why am I picking on Taylor Swift more than, say, Cardi B? After all, Taylor Swift is the good girl of pop music. And this is exactly my point. If the good girl of pop music winsomely is catechizing our youth to be okay with objectifying themselves and others, then I want to kind of raise the flag. Your kids and my kids are smart enough. You've raised them well enough. When they watch a Cardi B video, they're like, that's wrong. That's not what I want to do with my life. Most likely, that's how your kids are interpreting Cardi B. But Taylor Swift, the good girl of music, it's a much more confusing story that they're hearing from her. Many parents have put Taylor Swift in front of their elementary school daughters as a role model. Now, she makes some of the best music. She writes the best hooks. That's why she's worth $350 million. She's fantastically talented. God has blessed her with gifts that I do not have. But is it wise for our parents to put forward someone like her, not just Taylor Swift, as a role model for their child? Here's the question I want you to ask. What does voluntary objectification, that's Taylor choosing to dress a certain way in front of her teenage girl fan audience, what does voluntary objectification teach the heart of a young girl who's watching that? What does it teach her heart about the idea of power, connected to the question of, I would really like to answer this question in my favor, and the question is, will anyone love me? Am I beautiful? Does anybody want to know me? Those are the questions that are being answered through the hypersexualization of our young girls. So overt sexualization, it's not the main problem, it's only the symptom. We said this earlier, the human heart is the problem. The sin that's in our heart leaves us wanting and wondering. We're broken, and that's why we ask the question, am I lovable? Am I desirable? Do I have the ability as a young man to make impact and have agency in this world? Can I make a change for good? In the world, the culture is saying that one of the most effective ways to have those questions answered in your favor is to leverage your sexuality or to use the sexuality of another for your gain. And we're just talking about music right now. We need to teach our kids to be able to discern biblical truth from lies. And that's a skill that we have to develop, but it's also a hard skill to pass on to other people, to our kids. There's three simple lies that our culture is telling us and our kids through music, through media, through TV, all sorts of avenues. And I just want to show these to you real quick. They're not rocket science. So there's three lies we're being told. The first is this, that you are entitled to have it now. You are entitled to have it now. The concept of immediate gratification. We've been talking about this for, 30 years, ever since McDonald's came on the scene, maybe longer. This is true with our desire for fast food, on-demand Netflix, Amazon Prime shipping, which I find exceptionally gratifying. But also, it doesn't stop there. I don't want that box on my doorstep 2 days from now. It's also connected to this feel-good dopamine release that's associated with sexual arousement. We're told by our culture that you deserve that feeling. You deserve it right now. You can have it right now. You not only can you have it right now, you deserve it right now. Secondly, you're entitled to have it easy. We have smart speakers. Many millions of Americans purchased a smart speaker this past Christmas. I'm not a fan, but that's another conversation. You can say, Alexa, make me dinner. And she will say, I am sorry, I'm unable to accomplish that task. You say, no problem, and you get on your phone and you order groceries and they're delivered to your house by Amazon Prime. You can have it easy. Minimize effort, minimize movement, minimize discomfort and strain. That's the mantra of mechanization. Wouldn't it be great if we didn't have to do anything at all and just sit around? So if the youth of our day are being trained to seek a minimization of effort and a minimization of personal discomfort, we as parents must ask the question, what are the relational consequences of that message? What are the relational consequences? What effect does this have on, or if at a relationship, if my daughter approaches a relationship with the framework of, I deserve it now and easy, if that's the attitude, what's the consequence going to be relationally for my daughter or my son? Well, most relationships would fail because we know that that's not how human relationships work. If you're familiar, well, I would curious to know, raise your hand if you're familiar with Tinder. Okay, about half of you. So Tinder is an app that was created probably 3 or 4 years ago. It is broadly advertised as a dating app, but on a college campus, everybody knows that Tinder is a hookup app. This is the opportunity to have a fast and easy and almost anonymous sexual experience with a stranger, void of the challenges of real human relationships. We feel we're being taught that you're entitled to have it easy. But there's one more, and I believe this is the most powerful. You're entitled to have it void of consequences. You're entitled to have it void of consequences. The story being told to our young people is no harm, no foul when it comes to gratifying your sexual desires, either with porn or a consenting person with Tinder. If you feel like it, you deserve to do it. Nobody has the right to judge your moral compass. You're entitled to have it all without consequences. And these three lies are a recipe for relational disaster. They don't work in the real world. The truth is, and you and I know it, that relationships are slow, and that's okay. We know that relationships are challenging, and that's not a bad thing. And we know that consequences are real, and they matter. The whole concept of justice, the reason anybody cares about justice is because consequences matter, and they are eternal. As we get closer to wrapping up, I want to get practical with you guys for a moment. Maybe you didn't enjoy the theoretical, but I do want you to chew on this idea of the youth culture using their sexuality as a way to exercise power, to control their circumstances, particularly how people are interacting with them on those deep heart level questions of, will anyone accept me for who I am? Will I be loved? Can I make a difference in the world? But you parents are the gatekeepers as to what you allow in your home. You're responsible, not the minors that are under your care, okay? I don't think generally this has ever been said in the last decade. I was watching a CNN documentary that's called Being 13. I recommend you watching that if you have a preteen or a teen. It's a few years out of date now. And in it, they're exploring the social media use of 13-year-olds specifically. And it's horrific what they're finding. They're just sampling, 2,000 kids across the country. But in that documentary, they're also interviewing parents. And never once does he pose a question to the parent that's framed in such a way where a parent would have to take responsibility for anything that is happening in their teenager's life. The parent is assumed to be completely unresponsible for the fact that their 13 has a phone or that their 13-year-old has unlimited access to any app that they want or that their 13-year-old has unlimited access to the internet at all hours of the day. There's a sense of the parent is completely out of control and the sympathy and empathy is for the parent. Oh, you poor parent. I'm not willing to kind of admit that that's the case. Just as you're responsible to God and social services for feeding your children and clothing them, you're responsible to God for what you feed them through technology. You might want to pass this off or say, you know, that it's ridiculously hard to monitor what's on a device that's in my home, my child's device. You might want to say, well, my kids are smarter than I am with technology. I would encourage you not to seek to be a willfully ignorant parent. It's easy now, but 20 years from now, you might seriously regret that decision. There's a lot of tools out there to help you. Apple, 10 years late to the game, just recently introduced some very helpful parental controls if you have any Apple devices. You can purchase software to help you. Covenant Eyes, there's a thing called Disney Circle, which monitors your kind of your home network, like a virtual private network. You can limit apps on devices that children have in your home. You have the authority to do this. You can say those apps are not allowed on your device. You can take devices away. You don't have to let them have them. You cannot allow them in bedrooms after a certain hour. You can charge them anywhere you want them to be charged. You can lock out apps like YouTube or Instagram, which are two common apps that parents think are fine. And I would say you can get hardcore pornography on YouTube within 5 minutes if you would like it. Instagram is a pretty great place to view a bunch of sexy photos, which might not be great for your prepubescent 12-year-old son. You can filter Google searches. You can monitor things. All of these things are under your control. And I would say your authority, which means they're also in your responsibility. You're responsible to care for your children by pursuing these things. Now, you might want to argue with me and say, that's really not popular right now. And I would agree that that is not popular in the world of parents to put limits on your kid's device. You will be super uncool. And your kid will suffer a little bit for it too. Now, I've always said this to my daughters, you have complete freedom to point the finger at me to say, my parents are way uncool. That's okay. Blame me. Sometimes kids just need an out in a social situation. Make me the bad guy, but I love you, honey, and this is not good for you. Give your kid permission to put you under the bus. You might feel overwhelmed at like, okay, how on earth am I going to do all this? We have 47 iPads in the house. you might feel judged right now by some of what I'm saying, and my kind words to you are, so what? I really want you to wrestle with this. You are the boss in your home when it comes to technology. And honestly, the easiest way to help your child avoid pornography, but also other tech addictions or gaming addictions, is to delay their ownership and delay their use of devices. That's also not very popular and not very cool. But I will tell you what, in secular culture, the tide is turning. This wasn't originated, I don't believe so, within the church or within Christian community, but there is a movement out there right now, and it's called this, Wait Until 8th. This is the culture making a corrective after the iPhone and iPad being out there totally unprotected and everybody having unlimited access to everything in the whole world. They're like, man, that's not healthy. So this is an initiative put together by parents, not Christians necessarily, saying, let's come together and make a corporate decision that it's a good idea to wait to give kids a smartphone until the eighth grade. Now, I might say it might be better to wait a little longer, but hey, my third grader has peers that have iPhones. So if we wait from third grade to eighth grade, I think we're on the right track. So you could check out waituntil8th.org and see what they have to say. But it says this, their tagline is, we empower parents to say yes to waiting for the smartphone. And I want to reiterate that. I want to empower you to say yes to waiting. Now, some of you, maybe with older children who've experienced some of the challenges, real life challenges, might be thinking, my kid's going to see it anyway, right? So I lock their phone down or whatever. All they can do is going to get on the bus or walk down the street or go to a friend's house, and they have unlimited access anyway. Why would I go through the trouble of managing our 47 iPads and iPhones and accounts and putting all these controls in our home? Why would I go through all that effort when they literally can just go next door and get it anyway? Earlier, I told you that my first exposure to pornography when I was 12 years old. When I was 12 years old, I walked across the street to a friend's house where he had found his father's weekly renewed pile of VHS tapes. And it was there that I saw my first ever pornographic film, or that was my first exposure. And my parents, good meaning parents like you, like myself, would have a really hard time managing what was going on across the street in my friend's house in the basement with property that was his father's, right? I don't think my parents could have necessarily managed that unless I had been forthcoming with them and said, I think my friend is, that's an unsafe place, don't let me go there. They would say, okay, we agree with you, we won't let you go there. But I didn't do that, I was 12 years old. So I don't blame my parents in this. Yet, this is very important, yet, I was not exposed to this pornography under my parents' roof, okay? I had to go outside of our home, outside of our family experience to get this nasty exposure to pornography. My parents had set boundaries to keep me safe at home. Way easier back then. Okay, but they had done it. They were living by biblical principles and helping me to try to do so by enforcing house rules. There were different rules back then, but there were rules, and as a preteen, I did not like them. We fought about them. I yelled at my parents. They had rules, and they stuck to them. And the result was that I was not exposed to something like that in our home. And I was exposed to pornography in a different environment, an outside environment, that I connected not with my parents' lack of care for me, not with my parents' spiritual laziness, not with my parents throwing up their hands and say, we can't fight the culture. No, my exposure was in a household that I didn't respect any of that thing that was going on in that household. And because of that, I believe my view of pornography has always been something that's unacceptable. It's wrong. It's unhealthy. It's something to be avoided. And this is in part because of the efforts my parent made. Your kids need to know that you're fighting for them. They're going to hate you for it right now. When they're 27, they're going to reflect back and say, man, my parents, they didn't do it all right, and they were goofballs doing this or that, but they were trying to keep me safe at home. And I went to Susie's house or Billy's house, and I saw a mess. They're going to call it a mess because you've created a safe space at home. They might be attracted. They might dabble. They might even get addicted to it, but you're helping to teach them right from wrong. Your house rules teach your kid who God is. They teach about God's holiness, and they teach about sin and forgiveness and what restitution looks like. That's what you can only control so much, but your home is very important. And talking about sex and the dangers of pornography, morality is not the main objective. This is really hard for me. I want my kids to walk the fine line. I want them to keep away from sin. I want them to have good behavior. It's easy to parent towards behavior management. But morality is not the main objective. We have to connect how we parent to the good news of Jesus. We have to connect how we parent to the heart issues that are going on inside of our kids. It's not just stop that, don't look at that, it's bad. That's not enough. That's the symptom on the surface. We need to parent towards the heart. Paul puts it this way in 2 Corinthians 5. He says, for the love of Christ controls us because we've concluded this, that he died for all, that those who live might no longer live for themselves, but for him. I want my daughter to understand, okay, Jesus has done a work in me. I'm not going to live for myself anymore. I'm not going to live for the gratification of my own desires, but for him, for Jesus, who for their sake died and was raised. The motive for sexual faithfulness is rooted not simply in achieving good morality, but in a vital, trusting relationship with Jesus. That's what I want to encourage you guys to do. Moms and dads, this is your calling. It's much broader than this. We're talking about this little slice of pornography, but this is your calling. And I want to give a special encouragement to you dads in the room here. Your presence physically in the life of your children is extremely important. But not just your presence, your voice, your words, what you say is also very important to your kids. This is one opportunity of many, but for you men to reject passivity and to pursue your family. I want to encourage you to do that. I want to point you to a few resources that I think are going to be very helpful for you. The first is this, Harvest USA. It's not too hard to remember. You can jot that down, harvestusa.org. This is an organization that was created by Tim Geiger, and they launched specifically to address sexual sin, sexual temptation, pornography. That's also spread over into talking through same-sex attraction and gender dysphoria. They have lots of articles and videos that are very helpful. Secondly, I want to point you to, this is an event that Covenant Presbyterian is hosting. It's the Blue Ridge Bible Conference put on by the Alliance for Confessing Evangelicals. It's open to the whole community. Tim Geiger will be there, but also Carl Truman and Todd Pruitt speaking on gender, sexuality, and what it means to be human. This is the broader conversation. Pornography fits into this, but I'd love for you guys to consider coming. It's March 29 and 30th, and you can register online. If you Google the conference, you'll find the registration. And last resource I'd like to point you guys to are those in this room, to one another. You need each other. If you try to tackle this on your own, it is not going to go very well. We were created to lean on the body. We're one body with many parts. I'm going to pray for us, and then we're going to have some time to discuss some questions, which I'll throw on the screen as we gather around the tables and just mingle for the last 20 minutes or so. And before you leave, I'll figure out a way to, maybe I'll put some handouts on each of the tables. I'd love for you to take that resource. It's very helpful. But let me pray. Lord Jesus, we come to you very needy as it relates to us as parents. We've heard your word, and it's calling for us to raise our children faithfully in the ways of the Lord. That's our desire to do that. It gets really sticky and complicated when we add into that sexual temptation and pornography and the world that we're in right now. So I pray for great grace for each of the parents that are here tonight. Lord, I pray for great encouragement in knowing that you are at work in and through us, that you have not left us to do this on our own, but you've given us your Holy Spirit, that you provided the church, the body of believers, to support one another. Lord, would you admonish us to take action when we might feel lazy or we might feel overwhelmed? Might we be men and women who desire to shepherd our kids well, and are willing to do some hard work to make it happen, particularly in the area of pornography. Would you give us grace as we talk to our kids who are struggling? Would you give us grace when we find out that one of our own is addicted to pornography? Would we love well and point them to Jesus as the ultimate solution for our sin? We ask all of this in Christ's name.